Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Bruning versus.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Ortinger will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, the matter before you this morning calls the enforceability of a promise to pay child support. But it was a promise that was made both contractually and decretally. And under the existing case law, because the promise requires the making of payments after the children attain majority, the promise is not enforceable decretally after the children attain majority. It can only be enforceable contractually, if enforceable at all. So the question before the court this morning is whether the promise that was made is enforceable contractually. There is no dispute in this case as to what the promise was. There's no dispute as to whether the parties understood it. There's no dispute as to whether the parties abide by that promise up to a certain point. The only dispute is whether a certain legal argument exists that means that my client is not entitled to performance of her benefit under the contract after she has done everything that she was required to do under the contract. Now, I believe it is undisputed, and the trial court would not give me a finding on this, but I believe it is undisputed from the evidence that if our claim is contractually enforceable, we're entitled to a judgment for $110,000. Instead, we received a judgment for $18,000, which was only the portion of what was due that was unpaid that came due before the children attained maturity. So while we presented a claim for $110,000, we collected only $18,000 of it. The balance of that is what we were deprived of because the trial court determined that we had no contractual enforceability of our agreement.
If the 75 agreement is found enforceable as a contract, but not the 81 amendments to the agreement, is the record clear as to what the judgment would otherwise be?
I believe it is, Your Honor. That would definitely change the number of 110 because the contractual amount switched from 300 a month to 900 a month per child. But that's determinable from the record, and I think this court could render judgment to that effect without having to remand for a new trial to determine those damages. Now, the Family Code provides how interest is to be calculated on past due child support, and the conclusion of law number 7 states the court's reasoning on how the interest is calculated, and I believe that that's a correct statement of the law, but it was just applied to the wrong amount. It was applied to $18,000 instead of $110,000. So we stand before the court today asking the court to reverse and render judgment for $110,000 plus recalculated interest according to the provisions of the Family Code, and to remand on the issue of the recoverability of attorney's fees, because the trial court, in denying most of our relief, awarded my client only $10,000 in attorney's fees, and since that time, we have had to appeal this case to the Supreme Court, and if we are successful here, we would ask the court to remand the question of attorney's fees to the trial court to determine what a reasonable fee has been for this successful litigation.
Did the trial court make a finding on appellate court fees?
No, Your Honor, they didn't. The trial court only made a finding on $10,000 worth of fees out of a request of $35,000. However, if we're in a reversal posture, then I believe that the fact that we don't have a finding for attorney's fees now is a matter that is properly back before the trial court, because the court awarded $10,000 in fees on the basis of recovery of $18,000 out of $110,000 sought. And we believe that if the trial court knew that we were successful in 100% of our claim, that we would have had a greater award on attorney's fees than the $10,000. So we're asking the court to remand.
The $10,000 based on some type of percentage or contingency, was it an hourly?
The court didn't articulate why. The testimony was $35,000 in reasonable fees. The finding of fact was $10,000. If you read the statement of facts, the court says, I'm not going to give you all of that, but I'll give you $10,000. And the court didn't say why he was picking 10 as opposed to 15 or 20. And I'll grant you, Your Honor, that we do not have findings on what a fee would be in the event that we're successful on appeal, but then I believe if you reverse and render, we're proposing that you do, that you should remand on the attorney fees issue because the trial court made its decision on the award of fees on the theory that we were mostly unsuccessful, only for a partial part of our claim were we successful. Now, to move into this issue about the contractual enforceability of the agreement, it brings two matters together. One is Section 1406 of the Texas Family Code, which is no longer 1406 of the Family Code, but at the time this was the law and this is the law that this case would be decided under. Section 1406 of the Family Code provides for agreements in conservatorship proceedings, and it provides that the parties can settle parent-child suits, and that they can bring these agreements to the court, and that the court should approve the agreement unless the court finds the agreement is not in the children's best interest. If the court finds the agreement is not in the children's best interest, the court can reject the agreement and tell the parties to come back with a different agreement, or the court can try the case. If the court finds the agreement is in the best interest of the children, then under 1406, the terms of the agreement are to be set forth in the decree, and the parties are ordered to perform it. Then 1406D says, terms of the agreement set forth in the decree may be enforced by all remedies available for enforcement of the judgment, including contempt, but are not enforceable as contract terms unless the agreement so provides. So the family code says that if you bring an agreement and a suit affecting the parent-child relationship and the court thinks it's in the best interest, they should put those terms in the decree. But it's not enforceable as a contract unless the agreement provides, unless the parties provide. And
Mr. Arsinger, you at the outset, you said a legal argument's been made for not enforcing the 75 agreement. Is that the problem with the condition preceding?
No, Your Honor. That was not what I was referring to. I was referring to the Elfelt case. But I'll address the condition preceding argument, which the Court of Appeals mentioned in its opinion. Now, insofar as this idea of whether the agreement will survive the entry of the decree and be enforceable as a contract, Professor Sampson from the University of Texas commented in the Texas Tech Law Review, subsection D ensures that the agreed terms of conservatorship ratified by the court will not constitute a contract unless that is the intent of the parties. It's simple contract law. If the parties intended for it to be enforceable as a contract, they should say so in their contract. Otherwise, the law is going to say that it's not enforceable. Well, our contract does say that it is enforceable. And it provides this agreement upon approval by the court and incorporated, bad grammar, in the court's judgment, shall survive the judgment and thereafter be binding on the parties, their heirs, and representatives.
What part's bad grammar?
Upon approval by the court and incorporated in the court's judgment.
And what is the import of that clause?
I don't think that that makes any difference, except when you get to the Court of Appeals argument that because this was not incorporated in the judgment, therefore the contract never went into effect. And I'll address that in just a moment, Justice Baker, if you'll permit, because I want to bring into juxtaposition what I believe is the collision between the family code and this court's previous opinion in the case of Elfelt versus Elfelt, which is what I have reference to in my opening comment. Now, in 1987, this court decided a per curiam opinion, Elfelt versus Elfelt, in which the parties had a child support agreement on a modification order, and it was an agreed decree that was signed by the court. And the court went along in its per curiam opinion. It was doing just fine until it gets to the very last paragraph, and it says, this is, I'm quoting now your opinion, Section 1406D clearly requires that the parties to an agreement concerning the support of a non-disabled child over 18 must expressly provide in the order incorporating the agreement that its terms are enforceable as contract terms for the remedy to be available. Now, I read you this, the family code language that says that it will not be enforceable as a contract unless the agreement so provides. Per curiam opinion in Elfelt comes along and says it will not be enforceable as an agreement unless the decree so provides.
Think so, that's a belt suspended type of situation?
Well, in the Elfelt case, the holding was correct and the judgment was correct, in my view, because in Elfelt, there was no separate agreement and then later a decree. There was just an agreed decree. And in Elfelt, the agreement and the decree were the same document. So it is true to say that the decree did not provide for contractual survivability and therefore it's not enforceable as a contract. But that's the same thing as saying that the agreement did not provide for contractual enforceability and therefore it didn't survive the decree. The holding in Elfelt is correct because the agreement and the decree were the same thing. The agreement did not provide survivability and therefore is not enforceable as a contract. And those post-18 obligations under the Family Code 1406, the holding in Elfelt is correct. There's one word in Elfelt that's wrong. It's that the parties to an agreement must expressly provide in the order incorporating the agreement. That is not what the Family Code says. That is not what Professor Sampson points out. The purpose of the section was that it will not constitute a contract unless that's the intent of the parties. In the present case, the parties clearly intended that this agreement would be enforceable as a contract after the decree was signed. They complied with 1406 of the Family Code. This decree was 1975. This Family Code provision became effective in 1974. Elfelt was decided in 1987. So we're talking 12 years later, the Supreme Court in the per curiam opinion says, wait, no matter what the Family Code says, we're going to say that it is required that the order provide survivability regardless of the agreement. And I believe that that is an incorrect wordage. I don't think the holding in Elfelt was wrong, but I think the use of the word that must expressly provide in the order is wrong. The Family Code says it must be expressly provided in the agreement. Now, to get to Justice Baker's point, what about this condition preceding? The Court of Appeals said that this agreement upon approval by the court and incorporated in the court's judgment shall survive. And the Court of Appeals said, well, we're going to follow Elfelt. Same thing the trial court said. It's not our position as a trial judge or as a Court of Appeals to tell the Supreme Court that their decisions are wrong. We're going to follow Elfelt. Your decree doesn't say anything about survivability. Only your agreement does. And your agreement would ordinarily be enforceable under 1406D, except that it says upon approval by the court and incorporated in the court's judgment, then it survives. And the Court of Appeals said it was not expressly approved in the decree. This second agreement incident to divorce was not expressly approved in the decree, and it was not expressly incorporated in the decree of divorce. And since it was not expressly approved and not expressly incorporated, therefore, this agreement never survives the entry of the judgment because it wasn't expressly approved or incorporated. Now, we believe that this is wrong. We believe this is not correct, that the court actually specifically approved and incorporated certain language in the agreement and then took the terms of the agreement and put them in the decree. They match. The amounts, the dates, the cutoff dates, all of that is the same. The court did what it says under the Family Code to do, that it defines the agreement as in the best interest of the children. It should set out, its terms shall be set forth in the decree.
Or is it correct to state by the respondent that the decree approves the proper settlement portion?
Expressly.
Expressly.
I think the point that I make...
incorporates that, but your next point is it also incorporates the child support payment.
Yes.
It does not expressly approve it.
It does not expressly approve it, and it does not expressly approve... It only expressly approves the agreement of the parties that the father will pay no child support for their adopted child. It expressly says the court agrees with and approves this idea that the father will not pay for the adopted child but will pay for the natural children until age 21. But it doesn't expressly approve the part that says that the natural children will be supported at age 21.
Other parts of this agreement that were neither expressly approved or incorporated?
Yes, sir. The entirety of this agreement is reflected in the decree, which in my view is implied approval by the court. If you read the Family Code, it says that if the court finds the agreement is in the best interest, it shall set forth the terms in the decree and it'll order the parties to perform it. You know, the number of months payment, the amount to be paid, the medical care, all these other terms that are in the agreement show up in the decree, but they're not expressly approved. Well, we believe that that's a distinction without a difference. If the court has a choice of either rejecting the agreement in toto and sending the parties out to negotiate and come back with a new agreement, or else trying the case on the merits, neither one of those things happened in this case. The agreement was brought in. It was marked as Joint Exhibit 1. The terms of it were partially expressly approved, but they were also set out in the agreement. The very same terms, the very same dates, amounts, children's names, and everything are in the decree. That is implied approval of those terms. That is following the direction of 1406 to set those terms out and order the parties to perform them. We believe it's an overly legalistic view to say that the language upon approval by the court and incorporated in the court's judgment.
You earlier said that the party's intent was clear that they wanted this agreement to survive the decree. do you also agree that they were clear in their intent that the agreement had to be approved by the court and incorporated into the judgment?
We believe that it was clear, that was clear that the parties wanted that, and because a decree was signed that incorporated those terms impliedly, that condition was met.
You're not saying that what they said there is ambiguous, but your argument is, by the nature of the decree actually entered, that by implication, the court did approve the entire.
That's exactly what we're saying, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. John Pinkney, the third, will present argument for the respondent. May it please the court, it's basically my client's position that if you really look at this case, I think the review was improvidently granted, because if you look at the issue that has been raised here of trying to distinguish Elfell and 1406D as it was in place at the time, and saying, well, he's saying Elfell's all right. If Elfell's all right, then you got to affirm. I think you got to either, if you're going to do anything other than affirm, you got to change Elfell, you got to reverse it, or you got to modify it, because it says that it's got to be in the order. But irrespective of whether it's in the order or not, it was not in the agreements, and the trial court made factual findings to that effect, which were upheld by the fourth court. As to the 75 agreement, they found that that agreement, because it was not approved by the court in its decree, was not enforceable as a contract. And you got to look at it. If you look back at Judge Enoch's opinion in Hill, you see that distinction that you've got separate causes of action here. One before the divorce court, an enforcement of a child support obligation, and two, a contract, and particularly in this case, as well as Elfelt, you're talking about a contractual obligation for children non-disabled over 18. So even if the court set that forth in its decree in 75, it couldn't enforce it as a divorce court over 18 for a non-disabled child. The guy comes in and doesn't pay for a non-disabled child over 18, and the court having ordered it, in other words, let's say you take the agreement away. Just look at the decree in 75. The court is ordering child support be paid for non-disabled children over 18. Can't do it. It wouldn't. If I went in and said, hey,
you mean the parties in Texas do not have the power to make a contract?
Oh, they have the power to make a contract. I'm going to distinction.
To support a non-disabled child beyond the age of 18?
No, I'm saying
they have that power, they do not.
I say they do. Right. I'm saying
isn't that what was done in this case?
Well, that's what was done in this case. But in order for that to be enforceable, and you can see, because, I mean, what you're really trying to get around is the issue of sort of alimony. Parties agree that they're going to pay child support to the child reaches 30 years of age and going to pay it to the mother. I mean, that's the policy issue over 18, the third-party beneficiary issue of the child.
Aren't agreements like this sometimes used as part of the property settlement generally?
They may be, but there isn't any evidence of that, of any consideration for that in this case.
I guess what concerns me, Mr. Pinkney, is why is this so incredibly complicated?
Well, it
is. It seems like the parties ought to be able to reach an agreement, or if it's not their agreement, to make that plain as well, and that it ought not to be in doubt.
Well, because of this question that I just raised, if you didn't have an agreement, and the court let's say the court just set forth that it was going to order child support for a child, non-disabled child over 18, that divorce court cannot enforce that. That's why you say if you're going to make an agreement, you're going to make it agreeing to it as enforceable in contract terms. And you look at the Code Construction Act, and you look at the Supreme Court cases, I don't see how this court can change this decision of factual findings down there
following the statute, the clear construction, it says the contract agreement has to indicate that it's enforceable by contract terms. And that's, the legislature even mucked it up more the last time around. They actually put two new sections into the new family code of this, even as the support. One says conservatorship, the other says support. Changes it a little bit, but stays with the contract term.
Mr. Pinkney, is it your position, or I want to be clear, but for the trial court not expressly approving the agreement in 75, it would otherwise be enforceable as a contract? The terms of the contract itself would be enforceable as a contract, but the whole issue here is that the trial court did not approve it in its judgment.
Well, not only that, because it was written a little bit different. It said this agreement, upon approval by the court, a condition precedent that Justice Baker, I think, was referring to, upon approval by the court and incorporated in the court's judgment, shall survive the judgment. So you have a condition precedent to this agreement.
That's my point. Your point is if the decree had approved this agreement, it would be enforceable as a contract in your view.
Yes. And under the 75, you draw the distinction also of 81. The 81 agreement provided no provision that it's going to be enforceable as a contract, and that's the one that increases the amount.
Let me ask you about that, Walter. Are you in agreement that the 81 document was an amendment to the 75?
No question.
Does not supplant it, supersede, or
otherwise? I agree.
So if you read them together, where does your argument that you're trying to make now go?
Well, I'm saying I have to hinge it back, but I'm saying at least it didn't say in it either that it was enforceable as an agreement. But if you're saying you go back to the 75 and find that it was enforceable as an agreement, then the amendment, I suppose, you put them all together.
Right. So again, actually, right.
your
question, the crux of your argument is the condition preceding the situation.
No question about it. That's what it provided, and he can't have his cake and eat it too. He says Elfelt's correct, but it shouldn't have this deal as to the finding. But I say, with reference to Elfelt, if you follow that, that's what the trial court found. Followed. That's what the fourth court followed. They made the factual findings. That are there that you can't get away from, finding that the 75 agreement was not enforceable as a contract.
Were the facts in conflict on that issue?
No.
The facts were made simply from reviewing the documents.
Sure.
And the documents.
That goes back to the attorney's fees issue, which was raised by someone here about the remand. They gave him $10,000. They didn't ask for any appellate review. They didn't ask for any appellate review in the intermediate court or before this court. And that's why that issue wasn't. But they mucked around with five or six causes of action. So that issue would have to go back to conservatorship, injunction. I mean, there was all sorts of mucking around in the case. So I'm saying, this was the only issue at all in this case. Put it on the jury docket only because if you don't, and I didn't address it as to a summary judgment because I was afraid to, because it's something the courts don't like. And so I go before a trial judge, I get a good trial judge, I say to the other side, let's waive the jury. He says, okay, we go to a good trial judge, we follow this court's opinion, we take it up. That was the only issue. This was a $5,000 attorney fee case at the most. It was
What in the judgment do you think shows that the court disapproved the agreement?
Well, if you look at it, it mentions only on page 3 of the judgment, of the decree, the court finds that the parties entered into an agreement for the division of their community property. Okay, the agreement provides for, it is headed, title of it is Property Settlement Agreement and Agreement as to Custody, Support, and Rights of Visitation. But the decree specifically found The court finds that the parties entered into an agreement for division of their community property, and both parties have asked the court to approve the agreement, which the court finds to be fair and reasonable. And the court further finds that the agreement to provide for the support of Jacqueline Bruni, the adopted child, made by the family of Mary Ann Smothers Bruni, is just and equitable, and having been agreed to by our father, who has appeared herein, is in all things binding on all parties here too. So clearly, if you look at the facts, which are uncontroverted, there is any approval in that decree of that portion of the agreement.
Well, my question was, what's the disapproval?
I don't think it disapproved it. I didn't say it. We never made it. I'm sorry, I didn't understand you.
It was appear to have incorporated the
But it's got to approve it. And what, it didn't incorporate it. Because it simply said, finds that the parties have entered into an agreement. The both parties, it didn't find that it incorporated the agreement.
Mr. Pinkney, let me follow up on that question. If this decree had set out verbatim the settlement agreement within the decree, there had been no need to incorporate the agreement.
It set it forth verbatim.
So if the only thing that the decree has to incorporate is the provisions dealing with child support, if the decree itself pulls out just those paragraphs and put it in the decree, wouldn't that be incorporation?
Well, in this particular one you're saying then?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, in this particular case, yeah, but if you didn't have this last provision in the 75 agreement, that would not be true, because if you simply had that and you didn't have that it was going to be enforceable as a contract, you need those terms of art, because then you go into a common law cause of action.
No, I'm sorry. My question was going to be the incorporation in the decree, which is a mechanical
right.
fact. If the decree didn't say it incorporates the agreement, but simply sets forth verbatim the agreement within the decree, you'd have no problem that it was incorporated, would you? I mean, incorporation is mechanically putting it in the decree.
Without articulating, though, that this was an agreement by the parties?
And I'm not talking about the...
Just the
I'm
terms?
I'm not talking about 1406.
No, I'm not either.
I'm simply talking about the incorporation issue.
Well, but I'm saying I think you'd have to have some indication that it's incorporating an agreement of the parties. If you said the parties agreed to pay X number, and it orders X number, in that sense of incorporating.
So in your view, if the decree merely tracked the language of the agreement, that wouldn't be sufficient for incorporation?
I don't think so. I think you've got to have this, and you handle it in a footnote in the Hill opinion. You're not addressing the 14.06D requirement because you've got, in that case, on the Hill situation, Hill simply recognized that there was an alternative cause of action, and in that case, you found that the guy, you could increase the child support. You'd still have the agreement separate apart from that, but you could go back and increase the child support for a minor child, and this agreement wouldn't prohibit it. You see, that's where you get into the problem. I agree on child support that I'm only going to pay $100, and I put it in as an agreement. Then there's a change of conditions, and you come in and modify it, and in Hill's case, you say, hey, you can modify it, but only on a divorce court cause of action. You're going to still have your common law cause of action, because if you go the other way, you see, if you're going to enforce agreements and recognize them, they're going to always be binding, and there isn't going to be anything else. Husband and wife agree that I'm going to pay $100 a month. We agree, make it enforceable as a contract. Then she comes in for a modification later on and wants to raise it to $300. Nope, can't do that. We got a contract, you see, because you've got the separation of common law court and divorce court. And you upheld in that case that, yes, that contract's still enforceable, but it doesn't vitiate the authority of the divorce court to increase that child support agreement. So, see, that guy there was saying, I want to enforce that contract. We agreed that I would pay only $100 a month. I'm using some other arbitrary figure. But your court said, no. Irrespective of the fact it was enforceable as a contract, the divorce court separate and apart. That's the distinction in this case, is that we've got non-disabled children over 18, and when you're going to do that, You got to dot the I's and cross the T's and meet the statutory requirement, which wasn't met in this case as to either agreement, irrespective of LFIP. And we got the factual findings for that. We got the factual findings and the conclusion of law that that 75 agreement did not provide that it was enforceable as a contract. We've got that the 75 agreement was not enforceable as a contract. 75 decree was not enforceable as a contract. 81 not enforceable, either one of them. We've got those factual findings, and even if you say that LFELT isn't particularly applicable, we still meet the statutory, the 14.06D requirement, irrespective. And that's basically our position. We believe that if you read 14.06D in the Code of Construction Act and the factual findings that were made by the trial court, you can't do anything but affirm. I thank the court and I appreciate it. If there's any further questions, I'd be glad to respond.
Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Your Honors, if I may reply to some of the questions that you raised. To begin with Justice Cornyn's question, why is this so incredibly complicated? I think that's because of the process of legal advocacy.
Was it not really because of sloppy language by our court and procurement opinion, LFELT?
That provided the tool for the advocacy in this case. The advocacy is you're standing at the edge of a forest, and everybody can see that it's a forest. And Mr. Bruni comes in and says, "Man, I promised to pay support till these kids are 21. What am I going to do? I don't want to do it anymore." You can't sit back and say, "There's a forest there." You lose. If you're going to advocate Mr. Bruni's position, you say, "What's the forest made up of? It's made up of trees. What's this tree? This is the LFELT tree. What's this tree? This is poor language in the agreement. What's this tree? This is the argument that there's a condition precedent that if it's not expressly incorporated, that therefore it's somehow impliedly rejected." And I think I can go into court. I'm not putting words in Mr. Pinkney's mouth. I'm an advocate just like he is. But we can go into court and argue about trees, and we're going to forget that we're at the edge of a forest. What are we doing here? The family code says that if you make a deal, you can come in and you can tell that deal to the court. And if the court thinks it's in the best interest of the kids, then they should approve it, include it in the decree, and order the parties to perform it. Now, that's what we did. We had a deal. We don't argue whether we had a deal. We're not arguing over what the deal was. We had a deal.
Mr. Arsinger?
Yes, sir.
Sorry to interrupt you, but on the condition preceding to the enforceability of this agreement, which is one of the issues, approved and incorporated, assuming that you can incorporate an agreement by just sitting it out in the decree, which is one of your arguments.
Right.
How much liberality should we consider when you use the same amount of money and the same amount of time, but it's really not a verbatim recitation?
To me, Your Honor.
Provision? I mean, how far do we go saying, well, this is close enough to be incorporation?
To me, Your Honor, it follows necessarily if there is an agreed decree entered based on an agreement that you have incorporation as a matter of law, and you don't have to get down and start comparing word for word. The family code gives the trial judge two choices. You can either approve the agreement and put it in the decree, or you can reject the agreement. And if you reject the agreement, you either tell them, go bring me another agreement, or let's try this case. Okay? This trial judge did not reject this agreement. There is no implied disapproval, as Justice Spector was inquiring about. This judge did not reject it, did not send the parties away, did not set the case for trial on the merits. This judge took the agreement and signed a decree based on the agreement. Now, to me, that constitutes incorporating the agreement into the decree where the terms are the same or largely the same. Now, think about the word incorporate. I haven't studied Latin since the eighth grade. Incorporate means put in the body, corpus. If the terms of the agreement show up in the body of the decree, why does it matter if you use the words, the magic words, I hereby incorporate, instead of taking the terms of the agreement and actually physically putting them in the body of the decree? To me, if you cut away the argument over tree versus tree, and we get down to the simple issues here, the question is implied approval and implied incorporation good enough to meet the family code requirement? If the trial court's implied approval and implied incorporation is good enough, then we are not hurt by the conditional preceding clause that Justice Baker inquired about. The only other thing that would hurt me is the Elfelt opinion. And I think I've said, and I want to make this clear, I'm not saying that the Elfelt language is right. I'm saying that the holding in Elfelt was right because the agreement and the decree were the same thing. There's a word in Elfelt that's wrong, and that is that the decree must provide. The family code says the agreement must provide. So if you agree, if this court believes, pardon me, that implied approval and implied incorporation is sufficient to meet the family code requirement, and that one word in Elfelt is wrong, and you should say that in your opinion so that we don't have this problem in all the courts all over the state, then we win. We got $110,000, and we would ask the court for a remand. So thank you very much. On the attorney's fees.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will take another brief recess.
The audience, please rise.